You want to talk about your patient here?
Yeah, no, lovely. Well, this is one of a few cases I'd love to discuss with our audience because they kind of exemplify where we're going. This is a lovely lady who was originally diagnosed at the age of 62 in 2009. She had IgG kappa isotype. She had advanced bone disease, so she was a classic Drury Salmon 3. She had ISS2 disease at that time, but if you use the revised ISS, she was clearly ISS3 because not only did she have an elevated LDH, but she also had deletion 17 positivity by FISH. So she would fall into a high-risk category by any measure now. The important past medical history or concurrent medical history that's relevant was she did have quite severe hypertension requiring triple therapy to control her blood pressure. She otherwise fit and well. And basically, her initial treatment consisted at her local doctor's of lenalidomide and dexamethasone with zoledronic acid. We saw her and recommended the addition of a proteasome inhibitor based upon her high-risk characteristics. And she achieved VGPR with a very proactive approach to neuropathy using intravenous normal saline, partnering the steroids, using emollient creams and supplements with her bortezomib. We were able to achieve minimal neuropathy, just grade 1. She went on to autologous transplant. We mobilized her with high-dose cyclophosphamide at 3 grams per meter squared and then took her to high-dose melphalan at 200 milligrams per meter squared. She achieved complete remission. She really didn't want a proteasome inhibitor as part of her post-transplant mix, primarily because she didn't want to do anything other than a pill. So we agreed to that, although I did caution her and said, you know, I'm very worried about your deletion 17. You know, we're not perhaps doing the best here. But she said, Paul, bear with me. Let's give it a try.
Just out of curiosity, if that happened today, would you have given her exazimib?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Yep.
What will prompt you to switch to exazimib or utilize exazimib earlier, you know, maintenance, for example, or even up front?
Well, here, because, you know, she wanted a pill.
Right.
And because...
I mean, everybody would want a pill, don't you think?
Yes, but I think there's a more compelling reason for it as well. Exazimib really does give us the biggest delta we've seen in terms of benefit to deletion 17 positivity in randomized trials. The advantage in the Tourmaline trial for exazimib RD or exazimib lenalidomide dexamethasone compared to Lendex alone was staggering. It was at 10 months. Which is, you know, big PFS by any measure, Neil.
Could I just ask you a practical point? I think you mentioned Joe McHale a little while ago. I was talking to him, and I was asking about the GI toxicity. And of course, you've had a lot of experience with exazimib. And what he told me was that in his experience, it's not uncommon and that it usually is only in the first month. I hadn't heard that before.
I agree with Joe. It's early and manageable quickly. You can dose reduce, obviously, 4 milligrams.
But I mean, is it common?
You know, it's low grade, but it's an important side effect because it's an oral proteasome inhibitor, but it's manageable. And you start at 4 milligrams weekly, Neil, and you can easily drop to 3. And a little bit of low-dose steroid goes a long way with the GI side effects and also, frankly, you know, appropriate supportive care. So in my experience, it's very manageable. It's not... I was particularly impressed by our prosamib, which was an epoxy ketone oral inhibitor. It was very active, but unfortunately, the GI side effects were prohibitive. You know, you had people on 3 or 4 antiemetics and really getting sick.
That's the carfilzomib oral, sort
of. Exactly. But that's not currently being taken forward. It's still back to the drawing board to kind of figure out how to better give it.
Joe told me that when he starts patients on exazimib, he gives them antidiarrheals and antiemetics and tells them about it, et cetera, et cetera. Do you do that?
Yes, you can. Exactly. You absolutely can.
Yeah. Interesting. So this lady, let's see, where do we leave off here? She got transplanted.
Yep.
And what kind of maintenance did she get?
Well, she got lenalidomide maintenance 3 weeks on, 1 week off with zoledronic acid.
But you really wanted to give her, you would have given her what, RBD or what would you like?
Yeah, I mean, if she had allowed me to, I'd have given her bortezomib every 2 weeks, but she chose not to, and that's fine, completely understood. Nowadays, I would offer her exazimib, which would have met her need, which would have been oral. So nowadays, I'd have given her exazimib. In the context of what happened to her, though, Neil, it was very instructive. Her PFI was only, a progression-free interval, was only 1 year, and she progressed, which is a very bad sign in any setting. But it's particularly a difficult sign when someone progresses within a year on maintenance. As a practice point for our audience, someone who progresses within 1 to 2 years and isn't on maintenance, that's not the same biology as someone who is on maintenance who progresses within 1 year. But for either group, you know, you worry about these patients.
So did she progress biochemically or also clinically?
Biochemically and clinically, she reported increasing bony discomfort and fatigue. So we added bortezomib, and she did actually respond to that. But obviously, it was aggressive bortezomib dosing. It was not every 2 weeks. We went in weekly and then occasionally had to dial her up even more. But she had a nice response to the RVD platform again. But unfortunately, again, a short progression-free interval. Now, in 2012, I frankly wanted to give carfilzomib its due and try carfilzomib for her, ideally in a combo. The problem was her bad hypertension, and I was worried about that because obviously we have the vascular signal from carfilzomib. So we had a prospective clinical trial looking at pomalidomide, bortezomib, and dex, and actually she chose that because the neuropathy was minimal.
How much hypertension did she have?
Oh, she was on three drugs.
Oh, really?
And basically her baseline was 130, 140 over 80. And, you know, you basically worry about that because carfilzomib, as you know, can be associated with significant rates of hypertension. We believe that's because of endothelial actions that it has, which may also explain the DVT risk, the other things that we see with carfilzomib. So basically, and also may explain, obviously, the cardiotoxicity. So we believe in her that that was perhaps a choice we would have, but perhaps be kept in reserve. In any event, she went on to POM, bortezomib, dex on protocol, had a very good partial response, which was great. But again, classic for deletion 17 positivity, she was short, just 1 year. She progressed in 2013 with an aggressive relapse, and this was not biochemical, this was clinical. She had extramedullary disease, she really didn't feel well, she was really sick, and I was very worried about her.
Just out of curiosity, getting back to your early point about retesting patients, as she had these relapses, did you go back and see if she was still 17P or anything?
Yes, yes. On the protocol, for the 2011 progression, she asked us not to sort of poke her too much, so, you know, leave her in peace a little bit and see what happened. So we did. But for the 2012 relapse, we absolutely remarried her and did all the cytogenetics and flow. And sure enough, you know, she had plenty of 17P. I think a percentage, if my memory serves me rightly, was around 40%, which no one would argue with. That's enriched for 17P.
And just out of curiosity, what percentage do you need to sort of consider it 17P?
Well, I completely agree with Saga here. Any 17P is bad. I think there is a quantitative effect. 60%, I think you're in trouble. But I think anywhere in between also reflects that. I will share with you that in the tourmaline study, we did look at various cutoffs, and we showed that it mattered no matter whether you were 5%, 20%, or 60%. Having said that, clearly the worst was 60%.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
So what happened at that point?
Well, again, we thought carfilzomib because I thought, well, you know, I'm running out of options here and we just have to bite the bullet with regard to any vascular toxicity. Perhaps, you know, put her on low molecular weight heparin, something like that, and hold our breath with the blood pressure. But actually, at that time, we had the 501 study open and running in the phase 2 dosing with daratumumab at 16 mg per kg. And, you know, we had data. I mean, I basically had seen patients have dramatic responses with the antibody, and they could have horrible genetics and extramedullary disease. And so we basically went ahead and enrolled her, and she was on 16 mg per kg in the expansion cohort of that study. And bingo, she achieved complete remission, and she's been on it as monotherapy for over 4 years. And that's her quote to me this year, best I've ever felt since diagnosis.
At this point, how long do her infusions take? What happened with her first infusion?
Well, long infusion with the first. She tolerated it beautifully. She's now on basically 4 hours, I think around 3 to 4 hours. She's at the shortest interval you can give, and she's doing just fine.
Would you consider switching her to sub-Q, or you don't think it would make that much difference if it became available?
I think she's very comfortable with the routine, and I, you know, again, I'm very cognizant of her extramedullary disease, and I think that, as she and I sort of said to each other in jest, we're not going to mess with success.
Right. You mentioned before, incidentally, the high volume of sub-Q. Do you know what the volume is?
Yes, it's several hundred cc's.
Several hundred?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, yeah,
wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Huh. So let me ask you, if you were to encounter a patient like this again, same exact clinical situation, you're about to treat the patient symptomatic, you know, 2-3 relapses in, what do you think the likelihood is that a patient, nowadays probably they wouldn't even get single agent, but just in terms of your global take on the data, the likelihood that a patient would get a response like this to single-agent Dara?
Yeah, I think single-agent Dara is very active, particularly if you use it earlier. I do this frequently where I'll start with Dara Dex alone and then add drugs to it as needed.
Hmm, interesting.
But if I have someone I'm very worried about, Neil, I'll go straight in with a triplet, yeah.
Fascinating.